1 Corinthians, Paul says, "For we are God's fellow workers, you are God's field, you are God's building. According to the grace of God which was given to me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another builds on it. But let each one take heed how he builds on it, for no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ." In this podcast, we explore those who went the wrong way. We examine why it happened, how it happened, and who it happened to. But most importantly, we always ask the question, could it happen to us? Thanks for joining us here on Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods. Before we begin, let us be clear. The opinions we present are ours alone and do not represent the views or opinions of our respective churches or employers. Now, let's begin.
Well, good evening, Matt. We're here once again. It's the first Sunday of December. We're well into the holiday season, and we've got us a very special set of episodes this week. And your keyboard's mighty loud tonight.
Oh.
your mic's in a different spot, apparently.
Sorry, I got that mechanical keyboard. I was typing the title for this audio clip for us.
That's right. Well,
I noticed our tools have some new tools on here, and I got distracted. Squirrel.
That's right. Yep. It's always nice to try out new things, and I haven't looked at the new Riverside tools, but Castos, which is where we're hosting everything, has released some new stuff too. So,
how
are things going in your life?
Oh, well.
Any updates?
Going pretty good. We've gotten to, past Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. Did all those family get-togethers and stuff. Everybody in the family survived. Nobody ended up in the hospital. So win, win, win.
That's good. Yeah.
We're working on end-of-year things at work. Getting ready to wrap up the year. A whole lot needs to be done to end well. And so working on getting all that done.
So you work with a church here. Do y'all do a bunch of big Christmas festivals, shows, pageants? I don't know what word it would be called.
Respectful celebrations.
There we go.
You know, when you work in the nonprofit sector, the end of the year is always a big thing for giving.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to end well, start strong. It's our campaign for that. So we've been working on that. A lot of people like to support their church at the end of the year. It's been a rough year, economy-wise and things.
Right.
But the church has been growing, and you know, we'll play the disclaimer at the beginning of this thing that, you know, any of my opinions here have nothing to do with my employer's opinions.
Right.
But as for your question about Christmas celebrations, yes. So I have seen the schedule for that, and we have some marathon stuff happening on Christmas week. I expect to be putting in lots of hours. Christmas Eve, we're running services from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m.
Whew. Wow. We're not even running services that long.
We have a lot of people services that come to church and only so much space to put them.
Yeah.
And so we got to have multiple services. Christmas is on a Sunday this year. We will also have a Christmas Day service.
Right.
Just our traditional single. We'll just have a single service on Christmas Day. But yeah, on Christmas Eve, we're having multiple services from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. So I expect that to be a very long day.
Yeah. It's going to be a lot.
The good news is, driving home after 11 p.m., the traffic probably won't be that bad.
This is true. There will be a lot of police officers out, though. So just remember that.
Good thing I won't be drinking, since I'll be participating in church services. Not that I would ever, ever, ever drink and drive, because you drink and drive, that's stupid.
That's right.
Just add that disclaimer, kids.
So, okay, who are we talking about? What are we doing this week? What's going on?
Well,
that's enough updates.
That's enough. But we didn't even hear an update from you.
I mean,
on the spot, people.
That's right. I don't know. I've started working on my new website today.
Yeah.
The Downtime Theology blog. I've got it starting, so hopefully we'll be pushing some more out about that in the coming weeks. We'll stick that in our advertiser section.
There you go. I heard you got a new G-Ride.
We did. We got a new car.
Deluxe Platinum it out or something, right? I heard. Maserati Rolls Royce Silver Surfer? Ghost, whatever they call those?
It's a Ford.
It's a Ford.
Yep.
You like to buy American because you support America, right?
It's got the good tow package, so I can buy a camper next. And it can fit all my kids, so.
And a lot of guns.
I technically, yes.
And what would be your favorite type of gun, Brian?
That is an on-the-spot kind of question. I have not thought about that in a very long time. Because
we need to go to the range soon. I've got a gift card.
We do.
And I have not used it in 2 years. I hope it's still good. We should totally go to the range soon. Shoot some guns. I was supposed to go skeet shooting with a group at the church I attend, not the church I work at. And unfortunately, I mixed up my days and didn't get to go. I was very disappointed in that. One, because I'd bought a ticket for a significant price.
Right.
But two, I was really excited to shoot my grandfather's Sportsman 48.
Oh.
See, I grew up in Arkansas. Now, you're from Texas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm from Arkansas, but we actually grew up fairly close to each other.
Yeah.
And the culture's the same. We grew up in a gun culture. I'm going to guess your father and grandfather probably owned guns.
Yep.
Mine certainly did. I have my great-grandfather's gun that I inherited, and I'm super-duper proud. Best gun in my whole collection. I'm now a Texan. I live in Texas. But I'm an honorary Texan by virtue of my gun collection alone.
There you go.
It qualifies me.
Yep.
I'm not an expert in guns, but I do believe very much in gun safety. All of my guns are 100% legal. They are in specifications. They have all the things they need to be legal, according to the time period they were made. And all of my guns are not registered. Our listeners may be surprised to hear that there's no such thing as gun registration in the United States. Thank God. God bless America. You are required to submit to a background check when you buy a gun, but you're not required to register a gun. There is no registry. You can run a serial number on a gun and see when it was purchased, if it was purchased through a licensed firearm, a federally licensed firearm. Federal firearm license, an FFL dealer, federal firearm license.
Yeah.
Now, there's some loopholes to this where an individual is allowed to sell guns within state lines to an individual. So, like, you and I both now live in Texas and specifically in the same county. And if I was to say, hey, Brian, I've got this, I've got this little Colt 45 I'd like to sell you. S&W 9mm or something. Mm-hmm. I could go over and sell it to you for cash, and we don't have to register that or do nothing. As long as we're both over 21 and legally allowed to own guns. Now, we're only allowed to buy guns if we are not felons. Felons are prohibited from owning guns. That does expire after a certain amount of time in some people's cases with a certain thing. But for the most part, felons are not allowed to own guns. So there's some rules, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you just heard me mention a whole bunch of different rules here. And the reason I'm mentioning all this is I'm leading up to who we're going to talk about this week.
Yeah.
we're going to talk about the Branch Davidians, David Koresh, the leader of the group.
Specifically David Koresh. Yep.
Yes, the leader of the group known as the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Most people know them through the term Waco. The city of Waco would love me to tell you that the city of Waco has nothing to do with this. These were just some people who lived outside the city. The now deceased, lots of women and children would like me to tell you that the ATF agents and the FBI brutally murdered them on that day in 1993. The FBI and the ATF would like me to shut up and quit talking about this.
Yeah.
I think I've covered everybody in this conversation so far.
Yep.
Who would rather we say something different or not say anything at all. We're not the first people to talk about this. A lot of people have talked about this. It's been talked to death. Some people have taken what's happened there and used that for their own causes, for good and for very, very evil. The Oklahoma City bombing was said to have been done on the second anniversary of the siege in Waco in response to that. In response to that, these two terrorists killed a whole bunch more women and children and men, too.
Right.
See, it doesn't matter who did the killing. What matters is that we killed the children. They killed the children. The children died. That's the part that really upsets me and upsets a lot of people, honestly.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's the end of the story. The end of the story gets pretty graphic, and we're going to cover that. And y'all know me, mm-hmm. we'll probably cover it very graphic because I want this to be burned in your head. And I want you to remember this. This is one of the stories I teach my son on why we can't trust the government. I'm not anti-America, I'm not even necessarily anti our government, but I am anti-government corruption and government overreach and government having too much power. And this is a great example of why the government shouldn't have so much power. Why we shouldn't allow people to have that much power over us.
Yep.
But let's start at the very beginning.
The very, very beginning. So top of my list.
Yes.
Because your beginning starts in 1959, right? With David Koresh.
Yeah, because I feel like they're different groups.
Yes. They became different groups. So let's just start.
Let's start where you want to start, and the
history that leads into David Koresh, right? Is from a man named Victor Houtef, however you say his last name.
Who?
Right. In 1929-1930ish, was disfellowshipped, excommunicated. They probably wouldn't use the word excommunicated, but disfellowshipped, kicked out of a Seventh-day Adventist church.
So tell us just briefly, what's Seventh-day Adventist? Because I feel like that's not super common.
It's not. They're a group that is... They're different, right? They're Christian adjacent, right? But then again, I'd say a lot of Baptists are Christian adjacent. No offense to you intended.
Yeah, whatever.
Let me find. I know. I'm sorry. There's quite a few different beliefs, right? Teachings, doctrines, dogmas within the SDA. Oh, it's Giving Tuesday apparently. My stuff is popping up and doing all sorts of weird things because I wasn't expecting
so,
this.
So, I think some of the big things that people point... Well, I don't want to take too long on this because we do have a lot to cover, but I just want to just briefly
hit... We've got a whole theology section. Day. Yep.
Yeah, I just want to briefly hit Seventh-day Adventists, though. They're the folks who meet on Saturdays, not Sundays.
They meet on Saturdays. Yep.
And they're pretty...
Pretty conservative,
right. Exclusive group. They believe it's them and only them, from what I understand.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And they're not super evangelistic.
Right. Yep. And they have a heavy preoccupation with prophecy and eschatology.
Yes. Yes.
For sure.
So this Victor Hutov, he was kicked out of that church. Mm-hmm. Why was he kicked out of that church?
He was teaching things that go even further beyond what the SDA teaches, right? So when he was kicked out, instead of doing the thing that you're supposed to do when you're excommunicated, right, and evaluating yourself and figuring out where you're the one that's wrong, he printed...
Oh, I thought you were supposed to form a coven and attack the church and get burned at the stake.
No, no, you're supposed to take that time to repent and return. But he didn't, right? He wrote two books in which he shared his views, right? The first book was explaining the truth of the 144,000 from Revelation and to bring about reformation in the church. So he falls into that starting a coven and attacking the church category.
Right, trying to split them up and getting very strict. The 144,000, that's a pretty common strain we see in a lot of offshoot groups with this. They get really stuck in those scriptures in Revelation, which is really easy to misinterpret. And
for sure.
Try to pull one specific part out and say, oh, this applies to us, and here's what's going to happen. And they almost always end up adding to it, even though Revelation itself at the end says you shouldn't add or take away.
Yep.
But yet that's the most common problem that happens.
Yep. That's what Koresh did. But we'll get to him.
Yes.
His second book was, quote, a complete symbolic revelation of the entire world's history.
Symbolic revelation.
Yep. Yep. There's a key word there. So in 1935, he took a group of people and they moved to Mount Carmel, Texas, right? Which is, I guess, right outside of Waco, right? And in 1942, he completely severed any ties, right, with the SDA. It seems like they tried to kind of remain in communion. And then here in 1942, it's a complete severing. And so he formed this new group known as the Davidians, because Hutev believed himself to be the antitypical David.
What is antitypical?
So you know in the Bible, right, there's types, right? We can say Moses was a type of Christ, right? Christ is the antitype, right? He's the one that the type represents. So David was the type, and Hutev here was the antitype. It's a mess.
Okay.
So that's why he's the antitypical David, or that's what he believed. So they hung out there in Mount Carmel for a couple of decades, gathered a pretty large group of following from around the world, and then in 1955, Hutev dies. His wife, Florence, takes over. And then in 1958, 59, kind of in that general area, she called for all of the Davidian followers to come to Mount Carmel because it was the end of the 1260 days in Revelation 11. It was also to mark the beginning of the judgments recorded in Ezekiel chapter 9 and the removal of all Jews and Arabs from Palestine, the ushering in of the Davidic kingdom, and the second coming of Christ.
Whew, that was going to be a big old day.
It was. It was going to be a full week of stuff, and then none of it happened.
Wait, none of it happened?
None of it happened. I know.
The Jews, the Arabs, no coming of Christ.
Nope. Nothing happened.
Nothing.
Which I know is a shock. You know, I feel like...
I mean, there was prophecy, right?
Yeah, it's... So a whole bunch of people, right, out of this group sold everything that they have and moved to Mount Carmel. And, so a bunch of them decided they're no longer going to be Davidians because obviously something is wrong, right?
Well, and there's another group I want to cover later that does some of this, says when the end of the world's coming and then it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. It was actually quite recently, just a couple of years ago. And it's surprising who stays and who goes when something like that happens.
It is. It is. It's weird, right? You would think, you know, it would kind of be clear at that point that there's really a problem here. So several factions.
You've put all your life into this, and like you just mentioned about them selling their possessions and stuff, it's hard to give it up, even when it's obvious in front of you that it wasn't true. It's easy to say, well, we got this part or that part, but overall was right, or whatever.
Yeah, it's easy to make excuses and come up with, you know, there's a lot of them, right? A lot of groups like that that will turn around and say, well, it was a symbolic thing. It was this, it was that. It wasn't the actual event. It's just symbolism of the event, and make the excuses to keep it going. So Florence did this thing, and by the end of 1960, the Davidian group was all but dead, right? Hutef's group was down to its final few people. One pretty core group remained there at Mount Carmel, led by a man named Benjamin Rodin. When he arrived, go ahead.
Was this the time when Mount Carmel moved? Because that's what I don't see in here.
I don't have the timeline on when that happened. I didn't find
that. What we call in Mount Carmel, where the raid happened, was actually New Mount Carmel.
Right.
They actually moved Mount Carmel at one point.
I think that was probably under Lois or George Rodin that moved it.
I was thinking it was under Bid or right before Bid.
It might have been Florence, but I don't really know.
I mean, it's Texas Hill Country there. It all kind of looks the same.
Right. Yep. So Ben declared that his arrival to Mount Carmel marked the sign, right, that the group had been waiting for, that Florence had prophesied. So again, you know, coming back to, well, this was just a symbolic situation and there's more to come, right? Continuing the legacy of false prophecy. So he kind of renamed things from the Davidians to the Branch Davidians. And Rodin even went so far as to declare himself to be the fifth angel spoken of in Revelation.
Well, you want to change things to make them go your way. You just have a vision, mm-hmm. have a prophecy.
Yep.
So Rodin came in. He's the fifth angel. Now what are they trying to do?
So they're going along teaching the same kind of things. And in 78, Benjamin Rodin dies, right? So 15, 16, 17 years, right? They just kind of carried on the same teachings and experience. And then he dies, and his wife Lois takes over as none other than the sixth angel of Revelation. And I can only assume they're talking about the angels to the churches in Revelation because of the numbering, but
well,
who knows?
I find it very interesting that they had two of the men leaders die and their wives take over.
Yes, for sure. Yep.
Is that a pretty common thing in the SDA church?
You know, I don't know if that's common in the SDA church, but I do know that it's pretty common among a lot of the non-denominational kind of groups, right? Because it's about, you know, you as a couple are the leaders, right? So when one dies, the other one keeps going, right? Mm-hmm. Which kind of makes sense from a logistical standpoint, not from a theological standpoint, but logistically it makes sense because you're used to looking up to the same people. So it's common among groups that, you know, if their leaders are, what's the term for when a son takes over from a father?
Succession.
Like a succession kind of thing. Yeah. All right, Matt. So we have reached 1981, which is where Vernon Howell comes on the scene. And I know that you've got some history that gets into his childhood and his upbringing. So let's take a real quick break so I can plug my new website, and we'll go from there. Hey guys, it's Brian from Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods, and I just recently launched a new website, downtimetheology.com. It's my place to go and drop in my notes and my thoughts on various theological concepts and questions that I get asked and questions that are raised when we're talking about different cults on Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods and different ideas in the church over on Let's Talk Church. So come on over and join us. We're just getting started, right? So you can jump in at the very, very beginning and leave a comment, join the conversation, bring up your own questions, and let's see where this takes us.
Okay, welcome back. Brian, I'm excited to hear about this new website. This is going to be awesome.
It is, isn't it? I'm excited.
I just need to make sure that we don't go too far with this website. Don't you be getting popular and rich and famous on me. And then I'll be like, oh, I used to know that guy.
Yeah, that's probably not going to happen. You don't have to worry about that. All right, so tell us about Vernon Howell's upbringing. Who is Vernon Howell? Where did this name come from?
You know, as we keep studying these different cults, we keep finding things in common. And one of them seems to be name changes.
Yeah.
So we all somewhat from popular culture know the name David Koresh. David Koresh was actually born Vernon Howell. And he later changed his name to David Koresh. But he was born to a teenage single mother. She was 14 when he was born.
Now, I'm gonna stop you. Did he legally change his name, or was it just an AKA kind of thing?
He legally changed his name in the state of California.
Right. Okay.
Yes, it was. He said it was for business and promotional purposes.
Okay, cool.
We'll get to that in a minute. Because Vernon Howell was a industrious person.
Mm-hmm.
So he was dyslexic, and he struggled in school. And the kids used to make fun of him and called him Vernie.
That's quite the nickname.
Vernie?
Uh-huh.
Maybe I'm missing something. I was wondering why that bothered him so much.
It just seems interesting.
Okay. When he was 19, he was kind of a ladies' man or a little girl's man, and he got a 15-year-old girl pregnant. This is a theme we're going to find in his life pretty common. That's when he decided to find religion, and he says he was born again in a Southern Baptist church. I couldn't figure out which church it was. I don't imagine they want us to know at this point.
Right.
Yeah. But soon afterwards, he joined the Seventh-day Adventists like his mom. He didn't grow up with his mom much. When he was a kid, his mom often left him alone for long periods of time with his grandparents or other family members or other people. His mom married several other people. It's kind of in and out of his life quite a bit.
Okay. All right.
Even up and until the very end of his life. He was thrown out of the First Seventh-day Adventist Church because he was pursuing the pastor's teenage daughter. By this point, he's in his 20s. And he went and asked the pastor to give him his daughter, and he said no and threw him out of the church.
So is that the SDA church in Tyler?
I don't know.
Okay, because he came to Mount Carmel after being kicked out of an SDA church in Tyler, Texas.
Okay, well then that would be it.
Okay, all right.
That takes us to the 1981 that you were getting to.
Okay, all right.
This is where our timelines merge.
Yep.
And he met Lois Rosen, who was Benjamin's wife, after Benjamin had passed away.
Okay, yeah, Rodin. Mm-hmm.
Rodin. I wrote down Rosen, but it's Rodin, yeah.
Yeah, had me confused.
Yes. Now, it's important to know that, you know, as we've already figured out here, he has an affinity for young teenage girls. And, but Lois was not a young teenage girl. She was an older lady in her 60s. Mm-hmm. And he seemed to have an affinity for her, too. It said he had an affair with her. It was said that he was trying to have a child with her. And that their child was going to be something special from Revelation. But most women in their late 60s can't have children.
Right. Yep.
That's generally not happening. So, while he's out there at Mount Carmel, Lois is running the place. Mm-hmm. Her son George is around. He's kind of figuring he's going to be running the place soon. He's getting in buddy-and-buddy, you know, with Lois real good, living with her. And then he meets another teenage girl, Rachel. She's 14. He goes to her parents and says, "Hey, the Lord told me she needs to be my wife." So they said, "Okay, go ahead." He was actually still Vernon at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So go ahead, Vernon. Take her for your wife. They were legally married because in Texas at the time, maybe today, I don't even really know, but at the time, if the parents would sign off and agree, a 14-year-old girl could get married.
Right.
Then we get into the fun part. Do you want to cover the fun part?
Well, so... Rodin, so George Rodin... Right, the son, and Koresh did not get along.
Right, Lois's son.
Yep. They did not get along, and, you know...
Lois's grown son, we should mention this.
Right, yeah, he was probably older than Koresh, right?
I mean, so somebody shows up and sleeping with your mama, you might not like him much either.
Right, and, you know, knowing... You know, kind of some of the other stuff. You had said earlier that you felt like George was probably thinking, you know, this is all going to come onto me. I'm going to take over all of this, et cetera, et cetera.
His daddy was in charge. His mama was in charge.
Right. And Koresh came in and started talking about he was the one inspired by God. He was the one chosen to lead in all of this. And so... I bet that probably didn't go over so well with Rodin, with George, because, you know, George is supposed to take over. That's his mantle to take on, and yet Koresh is coming in talking about how he's going to be the one that takes over. So they didn't get along at all. And in 1985, Koresh leaves with his own group of people. Right, and goes to Palestine, Texas, outside of Tyler.
He was made to leave. The fights got run off, and more.
He was run off at gunpoint.
And Lois was gone by this point, didn't she? Yes. She passed away.
No, Lois doesn't die until 1986.
Oh, okay. But she's not in charge. George asserts that he's in charge.
Right.
And Koresh is and Koresh has some followers at this point.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he's got a heavy, heavy group, heavy following. And George runs him off, right? Lois dies in 86. George takes up his mantle as, you guessed it, the seventh angel of Revelation. Who would have thought, right?
How many angels we got in Revelation?
Well, see, and I never could find, and I'll try and find it for the theology episode, but I never could find which angels they're talking about.
Yeah.
I think they're talking about the seven angels of the seven churches of Revelation.
Okay, so we should be at our angels.
So this should be the last angel, the lukewarm church, the one that, depending on your eschatology, is the final position of the church before the return of Christ. That's a whole other podcast. Go check out my other website. We'll talk about it there. So in 1987, right, so Koresh has moved off. They're in Palestine, living in squalor, right? They're living in cardboard boxes, shanty town, whatever it takes.
Now, Palestine's in West Texas, right?
No, Palestine's just outside of Tyler.
Oh, it's just outside of Tyler. Okay.
Yep, it's just
so south there was
Tyler.
Already some land there that the Branch Davidians had or something?
No.
I don't know whose property this was. I
think they just moved out there as squatters.
Oh, right? Okay.
Which is why they never built proper buildings or anything like that. They were literally just lean-to tents, plywood boxes, not real living conditions. Yeah.
Okay.
So they go out there and
wait. We missed something that I didn't put in my timeline, but it's important. Before he was ran off, there was a $500,000 building burnt down at Mount Carmel.
Oh, really?
And George blamed Koresh for this. Still at this point named Vernon. George blamed him for this, but he was never convicted of it. And said the building was already unsafe and everything. They try to kind of blame each other. That was part of their big fight. I mentioned that because we're going to talk about living conditions later. There was a $500,000 building that was burnt down, so it would have been a pretty big building at that time. $500,000 went quite a ways back then.
In the 60s, 70s, 80s, that'd be a nice building.
Right.
So this is where things start to get interesting. 1987. Koresh and his followers are tired of living in squalor. And they're like, you know, we're going to go back. Now, there's some other reasoning behind that. It's not necessarily because of their being tired. But they went back with guns. And they engaged in a full-fledged shootout with Rodin and his followers at Mount Carmel.
Yes. Now, as part of this, Rodin, there's some people say this happened, some people say that wasn't exactly how it happened, but the story that Koresh gave was that Rodin had basically challenged him to, all right, if you're the prophet, prove you're the prophet, bring this person back from the dead. And they went to the cemetery that was out there, and George Rodin dug up a body. And Koresh kind of egged him on to it. He dug up a body so that they could see which one of them could raise it from the dead. That's important because, as you just mentioned, they showed up with guns and had a literal gunfight. It's George Rodin's property. Yet somehow, they're all charged. They went to trial. Koresh got off on a mistrial. All the others, his followers, were acquitted. George Rodin was imprisoned for murder. And the whole reason the police came out in the first place was not the gunfight, but because Koresh had told him that Rodin had dug up a dead body and was desecrating a grave.
Yeah,
what happened there?
There's
got to be something.
There's more to it that's just not out there.
That just makes no sense.
Yep. So after the trial, Koresh takes the lead. He takes over the compound.
I'm guessing the church technically owned the property, and so now he's over the church, so he takes it over. They also had to pay a whole bunch of back taxes.
Right.
Rodin owed a bunch of back taxes. Also, Rodin had some tenants on the property. He was leasing out some of the buildings. And one of them was running a meth lab out there. Koresh calls the police to have them evict those people and get the meth lab out of there. This gave him a... He already somehow got off on this whole gunfight thing. So he had some sort of relationship with the police anyway. And this just helped increase his relationship with local police. Right. He was actually quite friendly with the local sheriff's office.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I would say they liked him, but they knew him well enough to talk to him every day or on a normal day on the sidewalk type thing. You know, they knew him.
Man, I told you. Did you go and listen to that final interview with Koresh that I sent you on YouTube?
Honestly, half the time you send me YouTube things, if I'm at work, I can't listen to audio stuff.
Yeah, I know.
And so if I don't think about listening to it when I get home, I don't.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, listening to Koresh, you know, do I think Koresh was wrong and a cult leader? No shock, but yes, right?
And I don't think anybody disagrees with that.
But the way that he spoke to the FBI or ATF negotiator, Koresh was trying. It was the negotiator that wasn't. Just the way that he spoke. Now, the physical actions and things that happened after the phone call, who knows, right? But hearing you say that he was buddy-buddy with the sheriff's office, and yeah, I would believe it. I believe that he was probably really trying to have them on his side. Doesn't mean the things he was doing was right or anything like that, but...
He often had the sheriff's deputies out at Mount Carmel for practice, for target practice.
Right.
But they come out and shoot a few cans around, you know, for fun.
Yeah.
They had the land, and a lot of police are into guns as a sport, and they need the practice anyway for their, you know, livelihood. And so, yeah, he was very friendly with the local police stuff. Almost too friendly. Like, I have no idea how he got away with this, just taking this property back by gun.
Right.
So this takes us. Are we to 1990 now on your 1990. Timeline?
Yep.
1990 is when he goes in California. He owns a house in California. The church does, and he changes his name from Vernon Howe to David Koresh for business and promotional purposes. So it's important to mention here. He kept this house in California to recruit people into his group, but more for recruiting people into his band. He originally was going to change the world and tell people about Jesus through his band. He was into rock music. He was a very talented musician, and you can find some of his songs now that were later published. He got a house in California and was working in California to play shows and be in the music scene, trying to hit it big, basically.
Right.
And all his songs were original songs, and he talked about the things that he preached about. Stuff from the Bible and the seven seals and Jesus and those sort of things.
Yeah.
A lot of what we know from this group came from a guy named David Thibodeau, who's written a book and helped consult with some of the movies and stuff. And it was there in California where he met David Thibodeau. Actually, some of his followers met them and brought them to him. Brought David to him. Thibodeau to David Koresh. That's important because that's where we get a lot of information we have about the group, because a lot of people in the group were killed. And David Thibodeau was not killed.
Right.
Then... He goes to his followers about the same time. I actually think it was a little bit before 1990. I think I had that mixed up in my timeline. And he tells them that he's had a new revelation from God. And that he is going to take on the burden of physical relations. I don't want to get us banned on Apple Podcasts here.
Right. Yep.
Physical relations with all of their wives. That they no longer... They're going to keep themselves pure, and they're no longer going to do that. but all their wives are going to have physical relations with David Koresh instead. With the express purpose of impregnating them, he tells them that he is going to have 24 children, and these are going to be the 24 children that are going to rule the world after the apocalypse.
So, okay. Am I right in thinking that he's pulling this number 24 out as the 24 elders who stand before the throne in Revelation?
I think so. I've not studied that part extensively yet.
I mean, everything that he did, right, is around Revelation as if he himself was Christ, right? So I wouldn't be surprised if that's the reason that he pulled that number.
Yes, he was pulling that from the Bible. Yeah. I think that's where that was from, but I've not double-checked that. I should mention he never got to 24 children, but he sure gave it the old college try.
Right, he tried.
So he told all these men to be celibate, and any woman that wasn't with him should be celibate, except for the women that were with him, and he was very much not celibate with them. Again, isn't this such a common thing for a cult leader?
Yep.
He delves into this, and he would take more little girls, young teenage girls, and claim they were his wives, and physically abuse them, and impregnate them with their parents' consent in his group. So, you know, a lot of people make arguments for the Branch Davidians and David Koresh that they weren't hurting anybody. They were kind of on their own out there doing their own thing. But the problem was they were hurting these young teenage girls.
Absolutely.
I understand that standards have changed in our societies and et cetera, et cetera. But the standard in our society currently is that is rape. And I think it's important to call that out. And even that David Thibodeau, who was one of his followers, admits that, you know, he didn't see some of that stuff happening, but he knows now that it did happen. And yeah, David Koresh should have paid for that.
Yeah.
There was bad things happening. And I will say, eventually there are complaints to the Texas Department of, the Texas Department of Public Safety, Child Protection Services, Texas CPS, and they investigated and found no problem. Now, the thing with the young wives, if their parents consented,
right,
there wouldn't technically legally be a problem. And the complaints that were given was that they were abusing children and with corporal punishment and stuff. And there's been multiple accounts of whether that was true or not. A lot of the parents said that never was what happened. But CPS went out there, said they didn't see anything. It's very important to note that, and then left. They never took the children away or anything like that. Now, at this same time, CPS was dealing with several different groups in Texas and pretty much dropped the ball on all of those. As a resident of Texas with a child, I don't want to say too much bad about CPS, honestly.
Right.
But they've historically dropped the ball on some major things. So maybe they dropped the ball here. Or maybe there really wasn't something they could prosecute going wrong.
Yeah.
But I will tell you morally, he was doing wrong things. Yeah.
Yes, for sure.
I skipped right over the part of Koresh. Why he chose the name Koresh. So he's David Koresh. Koresh is from Cyprus.
Cyrus.
Again, I typed it wrong, but yeah, it was Cyrus, King Cyrus, who was kind of messianic in that he helped free the Jews, but he was not the Messiah. And then, of course, David from King David. So to him, that was he said that was his biblical name. He said that God gave him revelations at different times in his life. He was... Well, we'll talk later when we talk about how he preached and stuff. He was a very calm, pretty passive preacher.
Yep.
I could see you preaching that way. you know.
I don't know. I've listened to some of his sermons, and I don't know that I could do that.
Just sit down in a group. Okay, boys and girls.
No.
Today we're going to learn.
The ones that I watched, it wasn't like that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, from what I understand, he kind of went all over, but he wasn't a big, like, hellfire and brimstone guy. And that he didn't scream at people. But he just taught, right?
Yeah. He relied, and this is going to be something we talk about on the theology side, but he relied a lot, like a lot, on the people in the audience being able to quote scripture back to him.
Well, because like they had marathon sessions.
Yep.
He'd preach for 6-8 hours. He'd preach so long sometimes that he would fall asleep in the middle of preaching.
Yep.
And his people would sit there and wait patiently for him to awake and finish. And he would. Like, wow. Modern church, we can't get folks to sit for an hour for a sermon.
An hour?
These folks sit all day. I know, you're like, an hour long sermon? What do you mean? We should be 15 minutes for the sermon. 15 minutes for...
we're lucky.
15 minutes too long for you too?
I was going to say, we're lucky if the homily is 10. The rest of it's 3 hours long.
Well, y'all include a lot of extra stuff, though.
That's right.
Y'all do the kneelers?
Lots and lots of praying.
Y'all do the up and down kneeling?
Not so much, no, but it's a lot of standing.
Oh, standing, okay.
Like 3 hours worth of standing, but yeah.
I visited an Episcopal church once, and they did a whole bunch of the up and down with the kneeling.
Yeah.
Oh, my knees are killing me after a while. So, anyways, we'll go back to his timeline here.
Yeah, let's jump back over there. Who is this Henry McMahon?
So, this is very important.
Okay.
Somewhere around 91... He went into the gun business. He was already kind of a country boy, into guns and things, you know. And he met this guy, Henry McMahon Jr., who had moved to Waco because Waco was a good central point to easily drive to gun shows in Dallas and Houston and Austin.
Mm.
You could easily get to everything from there. And they had become friends meeting at gun shows. And he had bought some guns from Henry McMahon. And he figured out that he could buy AR-15 frames. Now, these aren't whole guns. These are just the frames from Henry McMahon. Henry McMahon, because he was a licensed firearm dealer, could buy these things in bulk. And what Koresh was doing is he would buy those from McMahon, and then he would buy barrels and triggers and other parts and stuff and put them together. For $400 worth of parts, he could sell that same gun at a gun show for $600.
Mm-hmm.
So they needed to make money out there at Mount Carmel. They had some business stuff they did, and some of their people worked at different things. But they needed a way to make some money, and they could make $200 a pop selling these guns. They claimed what they were doing was legal. Eventually, the ATF claims what they were doing was legal as well.
Right.
His deal with McMahon was to split the profits. Now, the ATF claims later on that he was taking these guns and he was modifying them and making them semi-automatic. No, making them automatic. They were already semi-automatic.
Yeah, they're already semi.
Making them automatic. So an AR-15 can be converted to an M16, which is the automatic machine gun that the military carries. The difference between the two is a little hole in there and then the selector switch to select it.
Right.
It can be, you can modify a AR-15 frame with the drill press and the right templates to become a fully automatic gun. The ATF claims that's what he did. They even went and visited McMahon. And McMahon showed them his gun thing. He's an FFL dealer. He has to. Showed him everything. He didn't have a shop. He worked out of his house. Called Koresh on the phone, and Koresh told the ATF, come on down and check out what we got. We ain't hiding nothing. But they told McMahon that Koresh was not selling the guns. He was stockpiling them. But Koresh was selling the guns. Actually, the day of the raid, two of his people were out selling guns at a gun show.
Mm-hmm.
And the ATF didn't do anything there. But anyways, that was the scheme that kind of brought the ATF into their world.
Yeah.
On there. The other thing important to mention is in 92, he brought equipment for a little beer joint near Mount Carmel to put a little stage up so that his band would have a place there in Texas to play. As much as he had the house in California and everything, he did not become super successful with his band.
Okay, that is interesting.
What's interesting?
You know,
the beer joint?
Yeah. I've tried to be very careful and make sure that we distinguish Davidians, Branch Davidians, from the SDA, but a lot of the teachings of the SDA carried into the Branch Davidians, and one of those being an extreme aversion to alcohol, tobacco, and drugs.
Oh, no, they didn't have this at all.
Okay.
They were not supposed to be getting drunk, but they did commonly go to town and drink beers at this club.
Okay. That was nearby. Well, that's reasonable. I mean, God told the people of Israel to go and buy not distilled spirits. What's the... Anyway, yeah, he told them to go buy liquor.
They had some alcohol at the at Mount Carmel. When we talk about the raid later, we'll bring that up.
Yeah.
About how they used some of that. That they would, you know, drink as a celebratory thing. But there was this beer club there, and David Koresh paid to have a little stage put in. Actually, he was a carpenter. He put it in himself.
Mm-hmm.
And paid for a nice sound system and everything so his band could play, and brought other bands into play. They were not just super loners. They came into Waco and participated with things in the town quite often. I think that's important to know. They weren't just holed up out there.
Right.
Actually, yeah. Right before the raid, Koresh was in Waco right in front of a whole bunch of the ATF agents. They all knew exactly who he was. Had they just wanted to arrest him like they claimed, they could have easily arrested him in town where he carried no security.
So let's jump to that day, right? Or, you know, leading into that day, because I know it was like, what, a 3 or 4 day standoff in total? But we're down to like our last 15 minutes of recording here.
No, it was it was weeks and weeks in the standoff.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah.
Because I know that there was stuff that happened in February, and then in April is when the actual event took place, but I didn't think the whole military of the ATF had showed up until just a few days prior.
No. They showed up on the first day, busting out of the back of pickup trucks, guns firing. It's insane what they did, but we'll get to that.
Yeah.
So yes.
Tell me about it.
So in 1993, the ATF raided, first without the FBI, and then later they brought the FBI in on it. They had been staking out the place for a while. They raided, according to them, looking for automatic weapons. They came and knocked on the door. Well, let me mention, one of their undercover agents who'd been living across the street and had made friends with them was in the house and actually showed them the newspaper where they got tipped off they were probably going to get raided that day. And he excuses himself. They all knew he was an undercover agent. He knew they probably knew he was. And he literally walked across the street to his house and then they raided the place. They came to the door and asked for David. David answered the door. And both sides have differing stories of who shot first.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody shot, and all of a sudden it was on, and it was a full-on gun battle. In that very first battle, David was struck in the abdomen. Not killed, but he was struck and mortally wounded right there. One of his followers was killed right there in the doorway. The ATF says that the Branch Davidians fired on them first. The Branch Davidians say the ATF fired on them first. A later eyewitness, the sheriff, when he entered later on in the standoff through the doorway, he says he noticed the bullet holes went from the outside in, not from the inside out. However, since the ATF burned the entire building, as they burned all the children inside, we don't have any proof of what happened, which way the bullet holes were facing.
Right.
It was a weeks and weeks long siege, and at the end of it, several people had been released, several people had chosen to leave, but David kept all of his own children. Any of his children were there, he kept all of his own children, plus a few others. And when they finally raided, they drove tanks filled with tear gas into the building, injected tear gas in the building. The most horrific thing that sticks to me, did you know that tear gas is heavier than air?
I don't think I know the, you know, molecular density or whatever, but right. I mean, I think it's kind of, it makes sense in my mind that it's heavier, yeah.
Well, the reason that's important is because when we were children, we were taught to stop, drop, and roll. We were taught when your house is on fire, you get down on your hands and knees, you get real low and get out, right? Because smoke rises.
But tear gas
when they
doesn't rise.
Lit the building on fire, and it said that, by the way, the tear gas they used was flammable. Tear gas is also flammable.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been without water and electricity for weeks, and they were heating the place with kerosene heaters inside. And the ATF knew this. So whenever those heaters got knocked over when the tanks entered and they injected with the flammable tear gas, it was fireballs going through the hallways. And the women who were trying to protect their children told all the children to get down on the ground, trying to escape the smoke. And what they did is they went into the huge concentrations of tear gas. Concentration is so high that it just killed them.
Mm-hmm.
The David Thibodeau guy who later wrote the story and tells us about a lot of this, he got out by literally jumping through a wall, thinking he would probably be killed as soon as he went outside. And for some reason, they didn't shoot and killed him. They put him in handcuffs. Mm. There's a lot more I want to tell you about this raid because it's so horrible, but we'll get to that in the next episode of this. That's not really time rhyme related, but right. It was a really, really bad thing. And most people did not survive the raid with the ATF.
Yeah, there were, what, like a 95, 96 people there in total that day, and 80 of them died or something?
I think there were a couple hundred.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah. Through the siege was a very long time. And quite a few people were released by David or were able to leave. He claims none of them wanted to leave unless he asked them to. Only one person has after the fact claimed that he held anybody ransom or held anybody against their will. All the others who got out said that's not what happened. That, you know, when they wanted to leave, they left, or he made them leave. Quite a few didn't want to leave, but as he was trying to make deals for food and supplies, they'd be like, okay, we'll bring your baby's milk, but we could only bring your baby's milk if you release some of them.
Mm-hmm.
I should mention the babies there were living off of breast milk and goat's milk. They did have a religious thing about drinking cow's milk. And the ATF took all of their goats and slaughtered them so the babies wouldn't have any milk. They made sure they set off fireworks and made a big spectacle of themselves and did it where everybody could see. They wanted to make sure the children seen the animals being killed. They also paraded all their dogs out and shot them one by one as psychological warfare against them. I just keep saying all these gruesome things because they did all these gruesome things, man.
They did.
They were horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And most of these people either were never prosecuted or, and here's our teaser for the next episode, some of the ATF members became millionaires off the atrocities they did. They were paid millions of dollars later, even though they did all these horrible things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just the end of the story. You know, for me, right? I'm so focused on the theology of things, right? That's just, it's what I do, right? It's what my degrees are in. You know, to hear all of the atrocity, it's just, it's mind-boggling. It's just...
His theology was way off from where mainstream Christianity is. However, they were not, there's no evidence they were stockpiling weapons to attack anybody, or they were trying to start a race war or any of these things like we've seen some of these other cults, okay?
Right.
They weren't even stockpiling weapons necessarily for self-defense. We're told that some of them carried a gun and some of them didn't. Again, it's Texas. This wasn't that uncommon. They had weapons because they were trying to make a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
They were using their labor to build these guns and sell them for a $200 profit.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I just haven't dug into all of that side of this story. It's just devastating.
For sure. So, what are we going to cover next week, Brian?
Next week, you've kind of alluded to, you know, the social issues. So, as being our next episode, do you want to just jump to that for the next one and do theology last?
Yes. I think on this one, we need theology last on this one.
Yeah, that's fine. Not a big deal.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about social issues next week. The things that went on within the compound, their relation to the world, and the raid. Sound like a plan?
Sounds a plan. We'll see y'all next week.
See you next week. Thank you for joining us here on Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods. Don't forget that we have our website, faithfraudsfalsehoods.com, where we post a more detailed blog with references so that you can go and take a look at all of this information for yourself. Also, remember to share this with a friend and help us get the word out there for everyone else. We'll see you in the next one.